The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're standing at the crossroads where the science of genetics meets the struggle to feed a world of over 7 billion people. Genetically modified foods are causing some heated conversation among scientists, politicians, and the public. So we're going to spend the hour talking to people who study plants and plant genetics to find out what science has to say on the subject. Kevin Folta was our guest on this very topic back in episode 71. Kevin is an associate professor in horticultural sciences at the University of Florida and the vice director of their plant molecular and cellular biology program. He studies the genomics of strawberries and light sensing in plants. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Desiree.
Carl Haro von Mogel is a PhD candidate in plant breeding and plant genetics at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. His research focuses on understanding the genes that make sweet corn taste so sweet. Anastasia Bodner is a presidential management fellow at the National Institutes of Health. She earned her doctorate in genetics from Iowa State University, where she focused on corn breeding, biotech, and sustainable agriculture. And Carl and Anastasia are co-executive editors at Biology Fortified Incorporated, and I believe they're founders as well, an independent nonprofit organization whose mission is to strengthen the public discussion of issues in biology, such as genetic engineering and agriculture, and that's at biofortified.org. They write and edit the BioFortified blog and forum. Thanks very much to both of you for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, delighted to be here.
So genetically modified foods, they have been in the news quite a bit recently. There's a ballot referendum driving debate in California. And a widely publicized study on GM foods and cancer is causing a lot of controversy as well, both for its conclusions and for the questionable methods that the researchers used. So we're going to talk all about these stories and more than that. But first, I want to know why we should be listening to you. Kevin, can you tell us a little bit about what you study at the University of Florida?
Well, I study basically what genes do, how genes that are unknown in their function connect to traits of agricultural interest. So we're very interested in how traits that affect small fruit flavor, how small fruit shipping, how a disease, how all these things contribute, how these genes contribute. And our goal is to try to provide a better quality product for the consumer, something that's better for the farmer, and something that's much more environmentally friendly. So our goal is to try to win all the way around. That's what we do.
Anastasia, what about you? You studied corn breeding. So did you focus on traditional plant breeding or were you studying GM corn?
I actually had a variety of projects that I worked on. One of them was to breed corn that had more balanced amino acids. So, for example, modern corn lines don't have a lot of methionine, which is needed for chickens. It's amino acid that they need in order to grow their feathers properly. So we are breeding corn to have higher levels of methionine. And then my main project was working on biotechnology, using that to increase levels of bioavailable iron in corn.
Okay, how about you, Carl? You are still working on your PhD in plant genetics, and I assume that involves some amount of looking at the genes of modified crops.
So my project focuses on a gene in sweet corn called sugary enhancer, and it's in about half of the sweet corns that people eat out there. And I'm basically a gene hunter. I've been hunting for the gene, and I'd love to tell you how that's turning out, but we'll wait until the paper comes out someday soon. But so trying to find the gene, find out what it does, how it does it, and then maybe we can use that knowledge to improve other crops or improve sweet corn, make one that's even better. And at the same time, I'm also doing projects to help people who are trying to learn about plant breeding. I've got these videos about how to cross different kinds of plants, everything from corn to tomatoes and potatoes, things like that. And so I'm also getting a minor in life science communication. And it's just been like this dual passion of genetics and communicating it.
Oh, we have a good group. Okay. So, actually we should say, because we will get asked later, do any of you have any financial ties to food companies that you'd like to disclose before we move on?
I have bees and I sell honey to people who want it. That's about the biggest connection I have.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. I received some funding from the Florida Strawberry Growers Association. It's a small amount of funding that we use strictly to forward our mission of trying to assist with current cultivation methods. So none of that money is used for development of commercial transgenic lines. So not used for GMOs.
Right. Anastasia, anything?
When I was in high school, I worked for a movie theater and we sold a lot of popcorn. other than that, no.
That is the most tenuous link. And thank you for being so open. So maybe what we should do is get some background on sort of what we mean when we say genetically modified foods. So maybe give us a basic description of what they actually are. Let's go with Kevin.
Well, it's a little bit of a misnomer in some ways because humans have been genetically modifying food for 20,000 years, mixing genes to control traits of interest. When we're thinking about genetically modified foods in the present vernacular, it really is based on laboratory manipulation of genes, adding a gene or adding a sequence which represses the expression of a gene via recombinant DNA technology. So essentially taking something from a gene that's a construct, which is or a sequence that's developed by scientists, that's placed in back into the organism and present in all the cells of the organism to do a certain job. And that's a really good explanation of what we mean by genetic modification these days.
So what kind of traits are usually on the wish list when we're tinkering with genes of a crop plant?
Well, we're really, right now there's really two major ones which are used, and that's resistance to herbicides, so that herbicides may be applied to a developing crop and remove all the other plants that can outcompete the crop. That one, as well as a small peptide, which specifically targets certain kinds of larvae from butterflies, moths, and certain beetles. Those are the two major ones. You also see commercialization of virus resistance in papaya and a whole suite of new traits on the horizon, which really are affecting fruit quality or food quality, as well as resistance to other herbicides. A number of different things on the horizon, most and also a lot to do with disease resistance. That's coming up too.
So is there a big difference in the precautions that we'd have to take when we're creating, say, a genetically altered tomato that you can just slice up and eat versus something like GM corn that's used as an ingredient in prepared foods and in so many other things?
So, like, you're talking about whether it's a food that's going to be processed like corn or whether it's something that's going to be eaten fresh. I know that the USDA, when they go through the deregulation process, they put together these environmental assessments or environmental impact statements, depending upon which crop they're doing and what time period you're looking at. But they try to take into account how people are going to be exposed to the food and the context in which it will be, and then figure out whether or not this is going to be something that needs like more scrutiny than others. You know, a lot of the foods that have been genetically engineered are things like corn and soy, canola and cotton. And we generally don't eat at least the kind of corn and the kind of soy that these are in their raw form. People don't really go out and grab field corn and start gnawing on it unless they're making a movie called King Corn where they did that, which is kind of silly. But, people eat sweet corn, but that's a slightly different kind of corn. People eat popcorn as a sort of a whole food after they pop it, but that's slightly different. And yeah, there would be slightly different concerns when it comes to, how much of it you're going to eat. If it's something that animals eat and you eat the animal, then you're not going to get really exposed to very much of, you know, whatever the modification is. But if you're going to eat a tomato, then yeah, you would, often eat that raw or maybe as a tomato sauce, something like that. So I think there is a little bit of a difference in the amount of scrutiny put on it, and I think also the amount of attention.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Anastasia Bodner and Karl Haro von Mogel, co-editors of biofortified.org, and Kevin Folta, horticulture professor at the University of Florida. Now let's talk about how GM crops are actually created. So it's not generally the case that we're just mucking around with the genes of a staple food source, right? There's generally a specific problem that we're trying to solve when we start working on the genes of a plant.
Well, yes, are you talking about breeding or genetic engineering?
Either, sir.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a goal in mind, whether you're breeding a new trait. If you want to make a really good sweet corn, you'll take certain genotypes that have what you're looking for, cross them together, and then get this whole array of combinations and try to find the one that's got what you want. For genetic engineering, it's kind of similar in that you have a goal, you have a trait you want to have, you pick some gene sequences and put them into combinations that you think are going to work and give you the trait that you want, and then you test it out and you try it in different, you know, different corns to see if it works in one and not another, and then you get something out at the end. So, I mean, I think actually whether you're doing genetic engineering or breeding, there is a good deal of planning involved.
It's really not at all, as some say, a blind process. This begins with a hypothesis, and well, actually, it begins with very well-described examples of gene function. We know exactly what genes do in many cases, and these genes that seem to provide some sort of fortification for the plant or plant products, some sort of benefit that can benefit the farmer or consumer, or the environment, these genes are very well-described, nowadays, it's so easy to be able to know where a gene is inserted in the genome and follow it, know exactly what it does. So this is an extremely precise science these days, despite what some people will tell you.
Let's talk about ratios here. Are you usually trying to alter the plant's existing genes, or is it that we've sort of changed and we're now usually splicing in genes from other plants or animals?
I think the answer to that is maybe counterintuitive. So you'd think that it was going to be more adding new genes, but I've seen a lot of companies moving back towards altering existing genes, creating targeted mutations using technologies that are sort of in between genetic engineering and breeding. It's a really interesting technology I think we're going to see a lot more of coming up.
That's interesting. So why are they moving backwards then? Or I guess, should we say backwards?
It's backwards and forwards. I think it has a lot to do with the regulatory system. I think they found a way to create traits that they want by altering existing genes and being able to avoid some of the regulatory hurdles that are set up for the type of genetically engineered crops that have new genes inserted. And that's obviously a benefit to the companies.
And in contrast, when it comes to breeding, you're often trying to find new genes to bring them into something that you're growing. In my backyard, I have this tomato called the Indigo Rose, and it's a purple tomato. Now, there are a lot of like purple heirlooms out there, but this one is actually truly a purple. Those other ones are red and green together. It's kind of brown. These actually make anthocyanins, the same stuff that's in blueberries, and they do it because the breeders at Oregon State University and elsewhere cross the tomato with wild tomato relatives that people don't really eat, and then got these two genes, one from each one, into this tomato. And now there's a tomato that turns purple on the skin where the sun hits it. And that's why, you know, when people talk about putting new genes in or mucking about or, you know, making all these alterations to the foods that we eat, there's a whole range of things that can be done in both genetic engineering and breeding, taking genes out, putting them in. And oftentimes we don't really know for breeding exactly what every gene is doing. I mean, if we did, then we'd be kind of out of a job, or I'd be out of a job. That's what I'm trying to do for my gene, figure out what it does.
We have a question. This is from Synovia 5.
Can GMOs be certified organic?
Ooh, can I answer that one?
Indeed.
Right now, the certification, which has been devised for organic culture, says you cannot have transgenics. It's purely arbitrary in that they automatically designate no zero tolerance for transgenic food. However, if we look into the crystal ball, I think that any kind of sustainable technology is good. And if you can take two very sustainable ideas, such as something that requires less fertilizer or less insecticide, pair that up with organic cultivation, that's the win-win. And that's really the subject of Pamela Ronald's book, Tomorrow's Table, which really talks about this marriage of these two very synergistic, potentially synergistic technologies. However, it seems a little bit, they seem a little bit polar at this point, at least in the minds of most people.
I'd also like to add something to that, is that for the United States, the organic regulations say that you can't grow it on purpose. If a lot of people are worried about, you know, if a pollen from a genetically engineered corn blows over onto an organic farm, that they would lose certification. They actually wouldn't. You can accidentally have it on your farm, and there's no problem for as far as the U.S. regulations are concerned. And I've also heard, but I need to find the farmer, that there is a papaya farm in Hawaii that surrounds their organic papayas with genetically engineered virus-resistant papayas to protect the organic ones from the viruses that would otherwise devastate them.
Cheating.
Yeah.
All right. We have a question by email from Kelly.
What is the relationship between GMO foods and food allergies? Have GMO foods contributed to the increase in food allergies we've seen recently? Could common food allergens be genetically modified to eliminate their allergic properties?
Well, the link between allergies and GMO foods is tenuous at best. There's no solid evidence that indicates a direct link between them. There's no causal link that's been established. Many people will say, well, the two correlate well, and many very outspoken advocates, or I should say opponents of GM foods, will point to the fact that the rates of allergies and the prevalence of GM food have risen at the same rate, failing to recognize that correlation does not equal causation. Quite to the opposite, what you're pointing out there is that what the question points out is that you can actually use genetic modification to remove the allergens. And this is a really exciting possibility for things like peanuts or strawberries, where they know exactly what the allergens are. They know what the proteins that are that develop the antigenic or the response. And to be able to suppress those, knock them completely out using GM technologies, or even the newer technologies that just edit one gene, would be a substantial improvement and really improve the quality of our food supply and less risk to people who are at risk.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking about genetically modified foods with Carl Haro von Mogel and Anastasia Bodner, co-editors of biofortified.org, and Kevin Folta, horticulture professor at the University of Florida. And we'll be right back with them after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guests this week are Kevin Folta, horticulture professor at the University of Florida, and Anastasia Bodner, and Carl Haro von Mogel, all people with very difficult names except for Kevin, who are co-editors at biofortified.org. We are talking about genetically modified foods from the perspective of three people who know a bit about the genes of plants. So before the break, we were talking a bit about what GM foods are and how they're created. So now I want to get into some of the claims about the dangers, because that's really the big thing. And I want to start with a recent study out of France that claimed to find a link between genetically modified corn and cancer in rats. And from what I gather from the science blogosphere, there were some pretty serious flaws with this research. Is that an understatement?
I think the best way to, and I hate to do a cop out here, but I would recommend that anybody who's interested in looking at Actually, Carl can probably point to some online resources for this that have been established that really go into it in detail about all of the flaws inherent in the study. The one that I like to point to, and we do offer also, Carl can point to the URL, a copy of the Seralini paper online. And the thing I direct anybody to, and you don't have to be a scientist to understand this, is to go to figure three, where they show three rats that have been given either GM corn, GM corn with Roundup, or just Roundup alone. And they show these grotesque, tumor-laden, disgusting rats that when you look at it, it's shocking. It just says, oh, look at how horrible this is. And it says right on each one, GMO, GMO plus Roundup in big letters. And to someone who doesn't know science would just be blown away by this. And it's even to someone who knows science, it looks really, really scary. What you fail to realize is that they left off the control. And the control, as shown by table two, also gets the tumors. So they go ahead and show the effects, the alleged effects of the treatment without showing exactly the same problem in the control group. That would eliminate all the shock of what they're trying to sell there. And I think when I say trying to sell, they're not testing a hypothesis. They're doing a demonstration for the fear factor. And that's my opinion.
So let's get this straight. Now, those rats were basically designed to get cancer?
Well, the type of rat that was used is a rat that's commonly used in all kinds of research, including cancer research. And they develop a high level of endocrine tumors very early in their lives. And by the time they're 2 years old, something like 80% or 70-some percent of males and 80% of females have tumors. So they did a study for 2 years and found a significant number of their rats had tumors. It's completely consistent with what is known about this line of rats. So it's a really, really strange choice for a model system to use something that inherently just gets tumors spontaneously. And then to draw conclusions about them and blame them on a treatment. It's really off base.
I think that it's really important to note that these rats do have use in other types of studies. Most studies, they're used for 3 months, 6 months or so. And when they develop tumors, you can quantify, compare them to other groups, make statistical conclusions. It's only when you've used them for their normal lifespan, that 2 year mark, that you, or maybe 1.5 years or whatever the threshold is, that you really start to get to that point where you can't really make conclusions about them any longer.
The way they set up the study is they had 200 rats in 20 groups of 10, and they had the males and the females separated, and they had 10 different treatments. They had one control, so there was 10 control female rats, 10 control male rats, and then they had 9 treatments for females and 9 treatments for males. And they found one of the groups of females had a really high rate of tumors. And you compare it to the control and you go, wow, look at the big difference. But then what about all the other treatment groups that were fed increasing amounts of GMO corn and then increasing amounts of GMO corn that was sprayed with Roundup while it grew, and then fed normal corn, but increasing amounts of very dilute amounts of Roundup in their drinking water. And some of them actually fared better than the control. And so they spent a long time in the paper trying to come up with, well, you know, how could this be? And so they decided, well, there's a threshold effect, and they're basically trying to come up with an explanation. They don't really have a hypothesis as a really workable one as to what's actually going on. But they use so few rats in each of these groups that when you do these long 2 year studies, you have to use a lot more rats per group, because the variation just it expands, and you get something. One person made a calculation that given the normal rate of tumors, you could expect that the rats could get anywhere from 1 out of 10 of them to 9 out of 10 of them could get tumors in that time. And so with that kind of variation, you don't really have the kind of thing to do good science to separate, is this because of the treatment or because of random effects? And if you pick just one group and said this one's got all the tumors, but then ignore all the other ones that didn't, that becomes a little problematic.
So despite all of these obviously glaring errors in this study, the authors are making huge claims about the effect of GM corn on these rats, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess this group is actually has a very long history of making such claims. And they use components of GM corn, such as the BT protein or other transgenic proteins or the Roundup, and they can kill cells in a dish. And they make tremendous overreaching statements about the significance of that. They can kill testicular cells in a dish using lots of Roundup, use tons of it, and only under certain doses. And then they make conclusions about this leading to problems in infertility throughout the world. It's a very consistent pattern that we've seen from this group, and you likely will not see a follow-up study that does this with a significantly large number of, or an appropriate statistically large number of subjects. And so it's something we see all the time.
We have a question from the website from Mike in Maine, and it kind of sums up everything I'm wondering right now.
It is apparent to me, a layperson who finds genetic engineering to be a fascinating subject, that Eric Ceralini has committed something that should be called a hoax, or at least a fraud. He designed his experiments to get the results he was looking for, and he knew what he was doing. My question is, why are there no repercussions for him? Why is the harvest of his fraud media fame rather than infamy?
I have just one thing to add to that I just can't, I can't let it go without saying, is that I don't know if there's any evidence that Ceralini has committed any actual fraud. So I don't think that we can say that without having proof. But I do think that we can question whether or not the institutional review board that approved his study was doing right by the animals that were involved. I think that there's definitely a discussion to be had at another time about using animals in tests such as these. But when rats who certainly can feel pain in some capacity are used in a study that is obviously flawed in design, I think that we really should question that.
So there's been a lot of coverage of this study, some of it very critical, some of it sadly not. But unfortunately, it's also been inserted into a political debate in California. And so we're talking about Proposition 37, and that's a ballot referendum that would require the labeling of GM foods and ingredients. Kevin, I know that you're particularly concerned about this proposal.
I am, because I think that laws, especially regarding food, should be made by scientists, or should, at least with that shouldn't be made by scientists, made by legislative bodies that are consulting scientists and independent scientists, not necessarily those that are legislators that are in the back pockets of large corporations, which does happen. Are attached to large corporations, but people who are independent, scientists who can consult on these things, rather than angry mobs that are freaked out by fantasy. And this is really the problem. You're going to see this act pass, and it's based upon, if you read the findings and disclosures in Proposition 37, there is nothing in the justification for this that is true, or at least is evidence that would justify having an act. Items like, this is their evidence for this. 50 countries, including Europe, blah, 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 disclose this, disclose if it's genetically modified. Some physicians think that it may be related to health-related problems. That's the evidence. And that's no reason to cause this dramatic change at this point. That's not to say we can't do labeling intelligently, but we can't do it by storming the fort with pitchforks and torches. It has to be done with some sort of scientific basis.
Well, we have an email from Mike here, and you can continue with that.
Why is there a drive to label foods as containing products from GMO? What would be the benefit? What would be the disadvantages?
I think that we need to talk about this debate at a little bit more granular level. Using a label that just says GM really isn't, it's not that interesting. You could say this product was created using hybrids. It doesn't really tell you anything about the product. Now, what we really could know is what the trait is. When I buy food or any other product, I'm really interested in knowing what is the environmental impact, what technologies were used that maybe made things easier for workers so that they didn't have to do backbreaking labor pulling weeds. But in order to know that, I'd have to know the exact traits. I'd need to know, was it BT, Roundup Ready? Was it virus resistant? Things like that. And I think that this overall GM label really doesn't give us any information that's useful.
I think the, in my opinion, the downside is that you have a rabid, resistance to GM technology that is largely uninformed. And when you look at the, sensationalism of the websites, the fact that they'll post the pictures of Seralini's rats and claim that this is the gospel of why this is poison. The misinformation, the, if you Google, GM foods and look at Google images, you'll have a good time looking at how, frightening the images are that they generate. My fear is that a label like this would be used as a warning label. And not just facts, not just a right to know, but a way to target specific foods and maybe specific companies that have a hand in their production. And people freely admit that too. People who are for Prop 37 will tell you, this isn't about right to know. This is about taking out a big ag. And that's what I fear, is just that it's going to be used as a way to instill fear. And I just think that's not a good way for us to be making decisions.
What I find interesting about this is that it seems to be the one issue where people on the political left are perhaps as wary of science as conservatives are on climate change, honestly. Are we seeing similar tactics used to sort of demonize GM food producers as we do from climate deniers?
Well, I think about this all the time. I think that it's exactly the same thing. You have a political left, which is that will say that every scientist, every single one of them, is bought and paid for by Monsanto and Dow Ag, that they fund all the research, that I've had people tell me that all my research before I publish it has to be approved by Pepsi because the University of Florida has a contract with Gatorade or licenses Gatorade to Pepsi. This is the level of dialogue we have. And the anti-GM movement, while it's important to have watchdogs and it's important to have people who are scrutinizing new technology, they're really starting to fall into the same hopper as the climate change deniers, the anti-vaxxers, the UFOs under Roswell people. There's always a conspiracy. You know, there's always some grand conspiracy that's holding down the truth. And that just, it's so sad because I agree with these people on just about everything else. How much of the misinformation is the cultural cognition phenomenon that Dan Kahan talks about? That just because you, since you align with certain values and certain ideas, you have to accept this in order to be part of that group. The misinformation about this, about the science of GM.
I am fascinated by that theory. And I think just from a, you know, a gut instinct, that makes sense to me. What do you guys think? Have you seen this?
I think it's like a sort of tribalism where you've got to identify as, well, you know, I'm anti-GMO because I, you know, want to be part of this group. And we see a lot of correlations like that. Like people who are anti-vaccine tend to be anti-genetic
Absolutely.
Engineering. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's actually hard to find somebody who's not both. At least in online discussions, they're the more vocal people. About where people shop for their food, you know, what authors they read.
You know, what I've noticed that I find fascinating is the one area that this does not come down to in terms of conspiracy theories is the 9/11 truthers. Those are from both sides of the aisle, my friends.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whenever it comes to debating an issue that has to do with the science, like of climate change, of genetically engineered crops, of evolution versus intelligent design, things like that, you know, you can have a whole lot of studies, a huge body of scientific literature, that will tell basically one story, you know, all sorts of different flavors to it and different complexities to it. But then you'll have a few sort of fringe studies that will say, wait a second, the sun is causing global warming. But then you look at all these other ones and say, well, no, it's not the sun. And then so like in the climate science, denial or skepticism, depending upon what term you want to use group, they'll take that one study and they'll say, you see, it's the sun, and ignore the rest. And that's kind of what we see going on when it comes to genetically engineered crops is that, you know, now there's this Seralini one. He had a previous one a while back that scientists basically debunked and said, this doesn't have anything in it. But you take this one study and use it to ignore this huge body of research that exists. And this is actually a project that we're doing on our website at biofortified.org. We decided to start trying to catalog all the studies that are relevant to how we analyze the risk of genetically engineered crops, everything from feeding studies to analyses of what's in the food, how does it change the composition, if it does at all, what does it do to the other genes in the plant, in the whole network of genes. And we actually have a list which people can go check out that's now up to 587 different studies. And Sarah Leaney's latest one is in there. We're trying to catalog them all. And we've got this project we call the Genetic Engineering Risk Atlas, or GENERA, that we just got a grant for from the American Society of Plant Biologists. And we're going to, in the next year, start plugging these things into a way that people can actually find them and access them, and maybe help people find more of the literature that exists and compare. You know, people can actually take a look and see how many studies say that, you know, it's not very risky. How many studies say that it is? And then how many are ambiguous? And let people actually take a look at the scientific literature and not have it be a big, dense list of citations.
Do you think it's really misinformation that's made the stigma of, I'm going to use a phrase, Frankenfoods, so strong?
Well, misinformation is part of it. But it's also, you know, we have to take a step back for a second and think, we are doing something that our species has not done before. And that is, you know, take a genetic sequence and pull it out of one organism and put it into another. Now, nature does do this, but it does it on a very long-term time scale. It's called horizontal gene transfer. And, you know, there's an ick factor. People don't like the idea of animal genes in plants. So, you know, there's a certain, you know, newness to it, and there's the idea that it's going to change the very essence of what your food is. But then, you know, we haven't been looking very closely at how has the essence of what our food is changed over time. Corn is not what it was when we first found the teosinte plant growing in Central America. So, you know, but the information sort of feeds into it. If there are philosophical objections, people hunt for, they hunt for a scientific reason, because values are things that people debate over. But if it's a scientific fact, then everybody's got to listen to your point of view. So people hunt for things like that, and misinformation just becomes so easy.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking about genetically modified foods, and I'm speaking with Kevin Folta, horticulture professor at the University of Florida, and Anastasia Botner and Carl Harrow von Mogel, co-editors at biofortified.org. And we'll be right back after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're talking about cancer, its myriad forms, many causes, and most promising treatments. We're joined by engineering professor Brendan Harley, who works on making cancer research more effective, and Dr. David Gorski, surgical oncologist and prominent science blogger. And author Kate Sukel returns to the show to discuss the efficacy and application of screening for breast cancer and what effect pink saturated awareness campaigns actually have on research and treatment efforts. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Kevin Folta, Anastasia Botner, and Carl Harrow von Mogel, talking about genetically modified foods from a scientific perspective. Now, this is the elephant in the room. The bad reputation of some sectors of the food industry isn't entirely unearned, let's say. There's a lot of regulation on GM foods, but companies like Monsanto don't always play nice either. For instance, let's talk about the fact that they make farmers sign contracts not to save or plant their patented seeds for more than one season, so farmers have to buy new seeds every year. That's kind of evil, is it not?
I don't know. When I was still at my university, I had a license to use JUMP. It's a type of software used for statistical analysis that I really, really like. It's JMP. Awesome stuff. And every single year, it was so annoying. I had to renew my license. You know, the school paid for it. You'd think they would have just given the software to the school, right? But no, they were constantly updating it. They were changing things. They were working really hard to make the software as good as it could be. And we had to pay for that license every single year. I find that the seed patents are actually really similar to software patents because they can be replicated. And if you're against seed patents, you also need to think really hard about how you think about software.
Interesting point.
One thing I'd like to mention about the patents with regard to seeds is, on one hand, we've had intellectual property with plants for a very long time. It started back in 1930 in the U.S. with the U.S. Plant Patent Act. And then since then, there have been other additions to it. And it's gone from everything from, you know, if you come up with a particular hybrid corn variety through breeding, you can put intellectual property protections on that so that someone else can't just take the same two corn varieties that you have and just remake the same hybrid and do all the work, you know, shortcut all the work you did. You know, the transgenic ones are a little different because the farmers aren't allowed to save the seeds unless they have permission from the patent holders,
right,
at least until the patent runs out. In the case of like corn, because corn is already grown as a hybrid and the farmers already buy the seeds again each year, that's really not very different. For something like soybeans, which just they self-pollinate themselves, you could save soybeans from your field and replant them and they'd be pretty much the same the following year. That would be something that's a little bit different. But on the other hand, because now those companies have a revenue stream from selling soybeans, they have an interest to actually spend money on breeding. And what I hear, at least through the grapevine from people who comment on the BioFortified blog and elsewhere, is that these companies spend half their money on developing the genetically engineered part of the plants, and the other half the money is spent on the breeding, which is just now done at a huge technological scale. It's like really sophisticated. And so that allows them to every year have a crop that yields just a little bit more than the previous year, is a little bit more resistant to a disease, things like that. But the companies can abuse that and they can go too far, if they have those kinds of rights.
Let's make a blanket statement. Do any of you think that Monsanto is doing anything wrong?
To me, it's a bigger picture than that. I'm not happy that there's really three different banks, that there's really two or three different major media outlets that own all the papers and own all the media, that there's really just three places I can buy gas from. Anytime that you're putting all of the resources and all of the choices into three or into a small number of companies, it becomes kind of monopolistic. And I would like to see more competition, especially with something that involves food. And in my mind, the reason that this kind of monopoly is allowed to persist, especially in the GM space, is because of the strict regulations and because that anytime even a small company like the Arctic Apple that's being introduced by Onokagan Specialty Foods, small company, it gets crushed by consumer sentiment without it even having a shot at being marketed. And this is what's leading to these big companies controlling everything in terms of the germplasm and GM resources. So that's kind of the downside, in my opinion.
Now we have a whole bunch of questions about a whole bunch of potential negatives here. What about the issue of modified genes contaminating wild or non-GM plants? Has that been studied or sufficiently studied?
Well, I'm not sure about how to say whether or not it's been sufficiently studied, but there have been papers that have looked at that. One of the perennial topics is genetically engineered corn in Mexico. And there was a paper way back in, I think, 2001 that said, oh, we found it. And then another one later said, no, it's not there. Another one said, well, maybe it's here. And so there's a little uncertainty as to, to what extent a genetically engineered trait, you know, will get out there into a wild population or a land raised population that people maintain of different species. But at the same time, if you were to create a new trait through something like mutagenesis. Like, we all eat things that have been created through blasting radiation or soaking mutagenic chemicals onto a plant, like ruby red grapefruit or Calrose 76 rice. Those traits can also get out there into wild populations. If you've got an herbicide tolerance trait where you can spray the herbicide on the crop and the crop grows, if you have a wild relative that's a weed, then you're just going to basically give the gene to the weed, and then that's not going to work anymore. And I think that's always going to be a concern, whether it's generated through genetic engineering or not. It's there are probably not enough people looking at all these different angles to where the genes can go. But I guess the real big important thing to remember is, if you think about how evolution works, if a trait gives a plant an advantage, then the trait will persist and sweep through the population slowly or quickly, depending upon how good the trait is. But if it doesn't, then it's going to sort of hang around at a low level, and I don't expect that that really would do very much.
All the things that are genetically modified, with the exception of papaya, there are no natural populations. These things are all alien plants in North America. And they weren't here 1,000 years ago, except maybe in exceedingly small amounts that are being carried by native peoples. These are all recent additions to our farms.
With the exception of canola.
With the exception of canola. Yeah.
And I would like to add just one more thing. There are definitely traits that will give advantages to weeds, and those are obviously herbicide resistance, which weeds will benefit from. But there are a lot of traits that weeds won't benefit from, such as nutritional improvements, that even if weeds get those genes, if they start expressing a whole ton of extra beta carotene, it's not going to give them an evolutionary advantage, so it won't change the populations.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Anastasia Bodner and Carl Haro von Mogel, co-editors of biofortified.org, and Kevin Folta, horticulture professor at the University of Florida. We have some more, many more questions.
Bring them on.
This one, well, we don't want to run out of time, sir. I'm mm-hmm. trying to choose. This is a good one. This is from Cassie.
Do we have long-term studies on the effects of GMO foods on humans? If not, how are the potential risks evaluated?
We don't have long-term human feeding studies. I mean, we actually don't even have long-term human feeding studies on really anything else that we eat. I've seen ads for trying to do strawberries back when I was in California to try to assess, really, what is this strawberry doing to someone's diet? But we do have long-term and multi-generational feeding studies done on animals, and those give us some information about what's going on. And so far, when the exception of the Sierra Leone one we were talking about, it looks like they come out positively. On our site on biofortified.org, we have a page about this show and this interview that says, "What do you want to know about GMOs?" And we've got a list of references about some of the things we talked about here. And one of them is a link to a review study of 24 long-term and multi-generational trials that was published, I think, last year. And for those, they didn't find any problems in those animals, biological significance. But there are all kinds of other ways that we can assess what the effects might be on us by looking at what's the composition of the corn. Does it change at all? And if it doesn't, then, the likelihood that there's a nutritional difference that's going to harm somebody or help somebody, it would be pretty low in that case. But we don't really do long-term human studies for that kind of thing. And can you just imagine trying to get that approved? We're going to feed somebody 11% of this corn, and they have to eat it for like 50 years. That would never even happen. And would it even give us the kind of information that would allow us to make decisions on?
We have a question from the chat from Insider.
Isn't the mass dying of bee colonies related to the GM food, which was modified for pest resistance?
Well, I'm the resident beekeeper. Take this one.
Yeah. I was just extracting some honey earlier today. So, The short answer is not that I've seen, no. And I care about my bees. I got some posts on our blog about my bees and how much I do care about them. So the insect resistance traits, it's a protein called BT, or CRI proteins are also called. And what it does is it goes after the gut, the cells in the gut of specific kinds of insects. And one kind of BT will go after the guts of lepidopterans, moths and caterpillars and butterflies, but it won't affect other insects. And then another kind of BT will go after beetles, but it also won't affect other kinds of insects. There are some BTs that'll go after the kinds of insects that honeybees are, hymenopterans, but those aren't the ones that are being put into these crops. And there actually have been a whole bunch of studies done on feeding BT crop pollen to honeybees, and they haven't found any of these kinds of effects. So I know that if you go on Twitter and you check the GMO hashtag feed, you'll see people every other day saying the GMOs are killing all the bees. But they usually just link to some source somewhere where they make the claim, and it never gets down to the scientific literature that actually has looked at some of this stuff.
So there is no evidence for this at this point?
Not that I found. And if I found some, and if I found it convincing, I would be first in line to say, hey, wait a second, we need to stop that right there, because, you know, I want to keep bees my whole life, and they're really important for our agriculture, and honey's delicious.
Very important. Yeah. But that is plausible, is it not?
Yeah, it's plausible. And it's also plausible that if we were to breed for insect resistance, you know, to breed a crop that withstands insects feeding on it, we could actually elevate toxic compounds that could also affect bees. But, you know, we don't have that kind of scrutiny going on that. It's just, you know, GMOs are a big topic and a lot of people focus on that. And another thing to think about is what is the risk of not using, say, BT corn? And in the case of corn farmers in the U.S., they used to spray a whole bunch of toxic pesticides on the corn, or they would inject it into the ground to try to kill rootworm beetle larvae and other insects. And those pesticides could also have been affecting the bees, but they're not being sprayed as much anymore. And so whenever we talk about like the risk, it's got to be, well, what's the risk with and what's the risk without?
Yeah, the broad spectrum pesticides coming out of the spray plane do not go on the BT field.
We have a question on BT, actually. This is from David Kroll.
The greatest objection to GMO foods I've received as a public educator is when we constitutively express foreign genes. What's the current consensus on human safety of BT-CRY1AB toxin?
Again, well, this is the one that Carl talked about before, is having amazing specificity. Yeah, that's it. And it binds a specific receptor that the binding has been biochemically characterized, and it's been well known for 50 years. BT is used on organic crops. So if you're eating organic crops, you're eating BT residues.
Really?
Absolutely. And it's approved for that.
And I'd also like to add, there are some, at least organic researchers working on injecting live BT bacteria into organic plants to be able to try to essentially do the same thing, but not have it, be a GMO, but just have the bacteria inside of the plant expressing the same protein. And, which I think is kind of, interesting and ironic, but, you know, it kind of shows you like the difference between one method and another, and the way we use it in these different contexts is not all that different sometimes.
Now, you mentioned the database that you're working on. Is that going to be kept up to date as new studies are released?
That's the idea, as long as we can keep it going. Yeah, we've taken on a huge project that will probably never end if we do it right. So we
hope it never ends.
Yeah, that's the idea. So it's quite an undertaking. I mean, our first goal is to get these about 600 different studies entered in so people can look at, you know, they can see what it is, and not everybody has access to the study itself. So in order for people to help try to help people make sense of it, we'll have all the information we can about it. And then people can compare the different studies. And then as they come out, we want to regularly keep on adding new ones. That'll probably be easier than this huge just data dump of 600 when we get to entering these things in over the next year.
How will you roll that out? Because I have a special interest in that.
Oh, well, so we want to have it so that it's viewable and searchable on our site. And you can go and take a look at the list right now if you want. At biofortify.org, just go up to the genera tab. It's spelled just like the way you classify life and genera and species and stuff like that. And you can see the whole list. But that's just a list right now. And we've got this spreadsheet that we're entering all the stuff in, all the different details. And then we're going to go through and read the papers and then classify the findings. And we're going to see who funded the studies. And if they don't say who funded it, we're going to contact them and try to see if we can find out who funded it. Some people can see, like all this information. And then we're going to make a way so that you can download the current build of what everything that's in there into your own spreadsheet and play around with it and find things that, you know, maybe you wouldn't, that we didn't find, patterns between different kinds of studies, which would be very interesting to see. So we'll have a way to view it and then a way where people can take it and play with it.
That is brilliant. Thank you so much for that. And,
sure.
And thanks to all three of you for being on the show.
Happy to have participated.
Yeah, thank you. And part of public education about this important topic.
You'll
it's what
find,
we do.
Say it again, sir.
It's what we do.
I want more scientists to say that. That's all I have to say. You'll find links to the works of Anastasia Bodner, Carl Haro von Mogel, and Kevin Folta on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Now, before we go, we wanted to let our listeners in British Columbia know about an event coming up in your backyard. The 6th Vancouver Skepticamp is rapidly approaching. Skepticamp is an all-day attendee-driven open conference, and it features short talks and question-and-answer sessions from grassroots skeptics and critical thinkers. And they are both amateur and experts. So the Vancouver Skepticamp takes place on Saturday, November 3rd, and that's on the campus of the University of British Columbia. For tickets, directions, or to sign up as a presenter, do follow the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And while you're there, how about you click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, where you can keep up with show news, and of course to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the program, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, our mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our studio assistants are Helen Cavillion and Chelsea Butler. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.